Ladies and gentlemen, welcoming to the WCSB Airwaves, the 8th President of Cleveland State University, Dr. Laura Bloomberg. And Dr. Bloomberg, welcome to the show, and I thank you on behalf of our wonderful station, WCSB, and all of our listeners around the world for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to speak with you today.
Dr. Bloomberg, I was going to ask you, we'll start out with the state of Cleveland State. In your opinion, where do we stand with Cleveland State University?
I think there's a lot of ways to answer that. I would say that I just delivered my State of the University address just a couple weeks ago. And I said a lot in that address, but overall, I would say when you think about our place in this city and in this region as an essential contributor to the economic and civic life of the region, we're great. I think we are doing excellent work. I think we are deeply engaged, and I do think we're essential. We can talk about some of the details, but if the big picture question is what is the state of the university, the state of the university is strong. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't say that you can't look at a major news outlet and not see something about the headwinds facing higher education in the country right now, and that is true at Cleveland State as well. So we're thinking about things like how do we buffer against some of those headwinds? How do we think strategically about having, say, a balanced budget right now today, even as we think about what kind of a university do we need to plan for in the future? How do we need to adapt and change? That's real work. And that's serious work. But it doesn't mean we're in a position of weakness. I think we are approaching this from a position of strength.
How is curriculum changed?
We are in the midst. I have just such high regard for our faculty who are, you know, I think right now in higher ed, kind of in the state of Ohio and somewhat nationally, faculty are getting a bit of a bad rap. And in many ways, it's undeserved. I watch our faculty working so hard to adapt and change and adjust our curriculum in a way that's relevant to. Yeah, you know, we can't just say that relevant to the 21st century anymore. I keep saying that prepares us for the second half of the 21st century pretty soon.
Is there a new student? I mean, the students have different attitudes about
it's
education.
It's a whole different kind of student. And we need to think about things like what is core? What does it mean to get a bachelor's degree and what should it mean? Or one of the expressions we use in education a lot, what should a student know and be able to do when they hold that credential? And so we're talking about that at the core level. What is the core curriculum? But students are also, you know, very cost savvy, and they're future focused. What is this going to do for me in my future? And we need to address that without, this is Laura's bias here, without kind of getting pulled into the narrative of workforce only. Of course, everybody who graduates college wants to earn a living wage and have a job or a career that inspires them. We also need to realize that the opportunity to attend a university is more than preparing you for one job at one point in time. It's really designed to prepare you for life, to understand your role in civil society, your role in the workplace, your role in neighborhoods and in communities. So I don't want to lose sight of that as we think about what a student comes in
right. Working. I don't think young students realize that the moral impact that they'll have later in life. I mean, as they grow older, their priorities change. They don't think of the things that we think of now. You know, they just go in and, hey, we're in college, you know, I want to get through this class.
Exactly.
I just want to get through this, I want to do this, and oh, I want to party on the weekends. But as you get older, things change and other things become important. You have a family. You think of providing for that family. And then, you know, like you say, you want to have something that you feel good about,
right.
A career. Now, we can't all do that. But if we may fall into another career that we didn't anticipate, but the skills that we learned at Cleveland State will still prepare us for that.
The soft skills, the problem-solving skills.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, how to write. I mean, not all of us have to write, you know, college papers when we're doing our jobs, but it's good to know how to write. Because a lot of adults who are very smart don't know how to write very well. It's
very true. You know, another area that is a big part of our looking at the core curriculum that I think is important to keep in mind, and students may not come to us thinking about it, they might come saying, I want a degree in nursing or in chemical engineering. But what the world is needing is people who can solve really complex, multifaceted challenges. And sometimes that's an interdisciplinary approach. So most of our innovations in our degree programs, also in our student-engaged research, are interdisciplinary. We might have chemists and engineers and psychologists and nurses all working together to look at something like healthcare access for people with disabilities. It's not just one field. It's a big, thorny set of problems that the world needs us to address.
So, the fields kind of intertwine with each
yes.
other. We all have to work together.
Exactly.
Because when I was going to school in the 80s, it seems like every college was completely separate from the other.
Right.
But now we're all coming together. And that was the same with the radio station, because the radio station was out there in the hinterlands. And now it's good that WCSB feels like it's more part of the university.
I love that. I think that's fantastic.
And that's what we want to do here. I want to make sure that anybody in this office has access to our station. They have to share information or whatever with the audience, because that's important.
And you have a number of students engaged with the station, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have about 75 different programs. Now, not all of those are held by current students. A lot of them are held by people that were students, but like me, that just stayed around. But they take it seriously. When you're on the air, it's not playtime. It's like you have fun, but you take it seriously because you're representing you and you're representing the university.
Well, and how long has the radio station been?
76.
Yep.
Yeah. It was in the cafeteria for a while, and then it went, just started to grow and grow, and then it was in Rhodes Tower forever, and then it's moved over to its current location on East 30th.
I think it's really important to keep that history in mind. It's a huge part of, certainly the life of CSU, but also the ways in which we tell our story. And I value that tremendously.
Kid Leo was part of all this, and he just got an honorary degree.
That was so fun to give him an honorary degree. That was just a year ago.
Yeah.
He was delighted to come back and be a part of that. And it was fun for him to connect with the students again.
Yeah. I wanted him to come on the show and talk about that, but he was unavailable. But
too bad.
Yeah, it would have been nice because I, I used to work at a record company and I used to deliver records to WMMS at the time. So I met him a couple of times when I was a kid. He was the biggest name in town.
Well, and there are people who say that he was really instrumental in getting the Rock Hall here.
Yeah.
And
Bruce Springsteen, it was
yes.
popularity. He broke a lot of his records. So yeah, he was a huge influence and. He was a bigwig in the radio world here in Cleveland for a long time.
So if I could name drop for just a moment, when we knew that he was going to come in person and accept the award, I reached out to the former director of the Rock Hall, Terry Stewart, and I said, I just thought I'd let you know that we're going to be doing this and you might want to come. And he said, might want to come. I would move heaven and earth to be there. If I'm out of town, I'm changing my plans. I wouldn't miss this for the world.
Wow.
And it was really fun to see this person who had been affiliated with the Rock Hall for so many years, recognizing the remarkable impact that Kid Leo had.
Yeah, he really did.
In this city.
I don't think a lot of young people realize how powerful radio is. And it's not the same radio that we grew up with.
Yeah.
Radio has become a lot of AI, where just like computer-generated music playlists. College radio is the last bastion of original, organic radio.
What a learning environment for our students. It's a perfect example of how learning doesn't need to and perhaps should never always occur in the classroom. It has to happen where life happens.
The only way I was able to do what I do is I went and did it and failed. And then I learned from that. And there was nobody teaching me. I just had to learn how to do it. I would be shoved in front of an audience and learn how to speak. Well, I didn't always do well, but you learn.
You fail fast, you get better.
You get better, right. That's the only way to learn, because then, you're more determined to be, I won't let that happen again. And I think that the radio station gives people that proving ground where, I'm going to, tighten things up and I'm going to experiment and learn about new music and be able to do all those things, take phone calls and interact with the people out there. That's That's invaluable training.
You definitely have to multitask.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you're, I have three computers. You have telephone lines, you have turntables, you have CD players, you have cassette, you have everything. It's all going at once.
You still have turntables and cassettes.
Hmm?
Because you have albums that you still play.
Yes. A lot of people up at WCSB use vinyl. I bring vinyl. I use my computer and vinyl.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, vinyl is very popular amongst the radio people. They love it. You know, it's great. It's not, you know, the sound is wonderful. It's just not practical to take to a party.
You know, right.
Back in the day, crates and records, but now you bring a laptop and you got a million songs there.
But when you hear vinyl on an old turntable, when you hear the needle hitting the record, it's a pretty remarkable sound. And turntables are making quite a comeback.
They are. They are.
You know this better than I do.
Well, I mean, I still have mine from the early 80s. I have a Technics 1200. It weighs probably about 25 pounds. And I used to take it to parties. And it's all these years later. It's, what, 40-some years later, it still works. And, but they are making a comeback. But people love, once kids get introduced to vinyl, they go, wow, I missed all this. You know, CDs are okay. But
are we dating ourselves by how excited we are about the... Well, and then there's album covers. The whole
that's
art
an experience.
Form of album covers is, you know.
You fall into it. You're listening to the album, and then you fall into the album cover. You're reading about it, the songs, everything. It's like an experience. Sgt. Pepper was one of those for me when I was listening to Sgt. Pepper. And then, you know, Pink Floyd and, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, whatever. But every album has its
own
little...
Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah, 73, which was recorded at the Abbey Road Studios in London.
But we're just saying.
Yeah.
Now try to make that transition back to CSU, Mr. Carr.
I can certainly do that because, you know, money is this university is, we're all driven by money, but for the money, that CSU gives you the best education, I think. And also, I think that CSU can probably offer you more opportunity for the money than you can get anywhere else in the state.
I think that's absolutely true. So, you know, we've been talking about the radio station. But there are people, I'm realizing, who don't really know that although we're not what's considered a Research 1 or top-tier research institution, we're a Research 2 institution, we have really active research labs in chemistry and biology and in engineering. And students have way more access to those labs than in many other places because our faculty are teaching faculty. So they're not only research faculty. So your professor might be teaching a class and then heading to their lab and doing groundbreaking research on gene regulation or on adaptive engineering for people with disabilities, and you can be right there with them. So those kinds of opportunities are different here. I came from a land-grant flagship institution, smaller than OSU, but similar to OSU, and those opportunities are very different.
Right.
Than they are here at CSU.
And a lot of people don't realize that.
Right.
And
we're working on changing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an engaged learning. That's the thing that you think of. And that's why a lot of people, when they go, wow, CSU has really come a long way. You know, it's like the Harvard on Euclid Avenue, as I like to call it, because it's got so much. And a lot of people, you know, say, hey, I got a really good degree here, and it's really helped me. And I know a lot of people that say that.
Yeah.
In the 80s, you probably couldn't say that as much. Now you can.
Well, and it also, you commented when you came in, it looks great. The campus is looking really, really nice.
It is.
And we're working hard. In addition to being a campus, we're a neighbor to downtown, right? We have partners in this community. And I feel like part of our responsibility is to make sure that it looks good here. You know, that we are... Our part, we're doing our part to beautify downtown Cleveland.
All right. We'll take a little break here. We'll be right back in just a moment. We're back with Dr. Laura Bloomberg, the president of Cleveland State University, and we are in her lovely office, and we're talking about many different things, and including one thing I want to know more about. A new division has been created, Student Belonging and Success, and it sounds like a wonderful idea. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, Well, I'm really glad you asked about this. First, let me say I'm glad you said lovely office, not really, really messy and cluttered office. I've been thinking about a division of student belonging and success for quite some time. Just for context, I think a lot of your listeners know this, but historically CSU has been a commuter college that a lot of people, you know, didn't live here. Very few people lived here, in fact. That's changing, but we want to serve still our students who live at home and commute in. But we have 3,000 students who live on campus, and we have a growing number of students who participate in our programs online. So we have a lot of different modalities. And one of the things we know nationally is that students who feel a sense of connection or belonging to their university are more likely to be successful in their classes and stick with it even when the going gets hard so that they can graduate. I also think it's just a great way to have a good learning environment if you feel like you belong, whether you're an employee or a student, it's a good thing. So that's what I've been thinking about. How is it that we create an environment here where a student, whether they're online or they're commuting in every day or they live right across the street from where they're taking classes, how do all of those students feel like they have a real connection and like they belong at CSU? So we sort of reframed a traditional student affairs model and pulled together a range of divisions that had been here but had been in different areas. Some of the divisions we pulled together had been in admissions, some in academic affairs, some in diversity, equity, and inclusion, some in student affairs. We pulled them all together and said, okay, this core group of you know, departments that serve students, you all work together and think about this. What would it look like if every student had an ally, a mentor, or an advocate who was beyond their faculty members who were, or their faculty instructors? Somebody who cared about them. Somebody who knew how to call them and reach out to them if they didn't see them on campus. Say, hey, we just want to know you're okay. What if every student belonged to an organization or a group of some sort? And what if asked, every single student said, I feel like I belong, like I am included and I belong at CSU? What would it look like? How would we design that kind of campus experience? So that's what we're working on.
What are some of the things that you're doing, that you're working towards in that?
We have reframed, we have not abolished, we have reframed how we think about the idea of student advising. So certainly students need academic advisors, and we continue to have and support a wide number of academic advisors, first-year experience advisors, and also advisors that are in colleges, you know, specific advisors for engineers as different from nurses. In addition to that, though, we have substantially ramped up what we're calling graduate success coaching and graduate success coaches who work with groups of people, our students, on all the things that might trip up a student that have nothing to do with academics, their life, whether it's helping them navigate support for mental health challenges or financial challenges, or maybe it's not even something that's happening with them, but it's happening with their family. You know, your mom just moved into hospice. How are you going to keep from dropping out of school?
Right.
And these coaches have an enormous amount of empathy, but also are really well trained to find resources and help students navigate those things. And if I can just make one more comment about this, there have been times when I have heard comments like, doesn't that seem like a lot of coddling of students? These are college students. Do they really need that level of hand-holding? You can't see my air quotes, but hand-holding,
yeah.
Air quotes. And my response to that always is, those of us who came from a middle-class household, a college-going culture, we had an intact family and a neighborhood that knew us and, you know, held us accountable, had that already. We had that. Mm-hmm. We're not providing anything to students that a lot of people don't automatically have. It just feels like water. It feels transparent if we've
right.
had it. So we need to recreate that for students who have all of the academic capacity to be successful but have not had those kinds of opportunities to be wrapped around with the measures of success that they need.
Well, I think that's great because, you know, students feel better about themselves when they go to class and right. they go out and see the basketball team play and they just want to be involved in other activities, and it strengthens the brand.
It really does. It absolutely does. And quite frankly, even if it's the right thing to do, it's financially a really smart thing to do because a student who graduates is going to, you know, be a greater financial benefit to any institution than a student who drops out. And then you think about the cost to society of a student who has some college that they've paid for but not a degree. And it is something that we should all work to address for those who seek to want to do it. I hasten to add.
Yes, I can relate to that.
We'll keep talking about that, yeah. Mr. Carr.
Yes, well, I keep working, you know, but I learn so much. Every time, I've always said to myself, without Cleveland State, I would be totally lost with my life. I hit a point where when I came back down here that I needed it. And it's the only place that would accept, you know, give me a chance again. And it's put me in the direction I need to be.
Now, yeah, those are the powerful stories that keep me going every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's how we change the world, or our little corner of it, is to create those opportunities.
Yeah, the TRIO program was a big help to me.
TRIO is a big part of this new division, by the way.
Yeah.
They're remarkable.
Yes. My parents never went to college. And, you know, my mom was educated, but she just never had an opportunity to go. So, you know, me going, I'm the only child, so I'm trying to, you know, forge new ground. And it's tough when you don't have a support system that understands academics.
So you know exactly what we're talking about.
100%.
Like, you know, if you had support, I mean, you seem to have done just fine with your life. But there are students who come from those kinds of circumstances. Yeah. And then one misstep, speeding ticket or a car breakdown or, you know, whatever, something happens in your family can make or break your success.
Yes.
And now think about the young person who has two parents who have gone to college. They understand the ropes. They maybe can afford to pay the tuition for their kid. If the car breaks down, the first call you make is to mom or dad because they'll help you fix it. Those are protective factors that most of our students don't have. How is it that we've
That they have that cushion.
Yep.
I don't think some kids' students realize how fortunate they are to have that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It just seems transparent to us. Like, well, doesn't every kid have that? Doesn't every family have that?
No. No. And there's kids that are really smart that have learning disabilities that come to school that know things, but they are having trouble putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. And you know, they know what they want to do, but there's some things, the hoops they have to jump through, and they're having a hard time doing it.
Correct.
And these are a little ambiguous to, you know, but they need people to be able to sit down with that student and say, look, I know you're having trouble in this area, but we're going to help you get through it. And we know the people that can do that. And that would make the student go, wow, you know, sometimes the student would feel like they're not very smart because they can't do it, but they really can. They're not approaching it from the right direction.
So I have a friend who is an exceptionally successful attorney in New York City who was headed for a separate special school in eighth grade because he still was not able to read. And by the time somebody diagnosed him as severely dyslexic, he was almost ready to head off the deep end of drug abuse, dropping out, crime. And got the right level of support. By the time he graduated from law school with honors from an Ivy League institution, he had all of the adaptive, he's still severely autistic, dyslexic. But he's also wildly successful because somebody figured out that it's not necessarily related to your capacity to be academically successful. I think that's huge. I misspoke and said autistic because I think we're realizing that's true of people with some forms of autism as well. And we do have a number of students here who would be considered on the autism spectrum disorder, wildly successful in school, but need some support with social interactions with people, navigating busy environments. but they can be academically successful.
Yeah.
And huge contributors to society if we figure out how to...
how to utilize it.
Yeah, exactly.
Are they changing... is there any program or anything directed at the instructors of the professors of how they teach their classes? Are they thinking of new ways to approach traditional topics?
Yes. And we need to keep doing that. I wouldn't say that we're exactly where we need to be. I think change is hard. And if you have done something the same way for a long time, sometimes it feels almost impossible to change. And part of the challenge is to know what, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. You and I were just talking about vinyl records.
Hmm.
You know, there's a place for some of these things still.
Right.
And it's maybe not central, but there's still a place. So all teaching strategies don't necessarily need to change, but we do need to adapt, and we do need to understand the learning environments that the majority of our students grew up in. So if you see a toddler in 2023 approach a TV screen, and more often than not, they're going to try to use their finger to move things around because they're used to touch screens.
Right.
They are digital natives in this world.
Right.
That's been happening for a while. When those students come to a university, they come as digital natives, and we've got the vast majority of our faculty members are still individuals who, like you and I, would have learned technology later in our lives. We need to figure out how to bridge that divide effectively. And that doesn't mean we automate everything. That doesn't mean we use technology as a gizmo or gadget in all elements of our teaching. But it does mean we have to understand how our students have learned up to this point in their life.
Yeah, well said. Have they ever thought of using AI for any teaching?
Yeah. So AI, it's this term that we use. It's so broad. It encompasses so many things. So usually when we talk about AI in the university setting, we're talking about these large language models, these AI tools that have aggregated unimaginably large amounts of data from all kinds of sources in online. And the most recent tool on the scene last year was ChatGPT, and it really... caught people somewhat by surprise, which is kind of funny because we've been talking about the evolution of AI for decades now.
Yeah.
On university campuses, it led to conversations about how are we going to stop cheating? How are we going to know a student wrote their own paper? All of these concerns. I'm really proud of a group of faculty at CSU who said, well, it's coming. We're not going to be able to stop it. So how do we think about a little, academic jujitsu, if you will, and use it to our advantage? How do we study and understand how students might be thinking about something like ChatGPT so we can become partners and use it as a learning tool? And so we've got faculty who are very engaged in that and are actually leaders in a way. They're publishing a lot of recommendations and study guides for using AI, and most specifically right now, ChatGPT in the classroom.
That's great. What areas as a university, since you have been here, what areas have they grown the most in?
Academic areas?
Yes.
Good question. Many of our business programs are growing. And engineering, two big areas that we have prioritized through some of our partnerships with the state. We are growing. So some of what we have done in this past year is realign our colleges, back to our conversation about interdisciplinarity. So some of our colleges on the face of that may not look like they're growing, but it's because we've moved departments around. Our nursing program is strong,
yeah,
although it could be growing more, and we need to figure that out. But I would identify probably right now programs in business, finance particularly, and in engineering.
When somebody says, well, I attended an Ivy League school, and then another person says, well, I went to Cleveland State, and you think, well, the Ivy League school must have given them a much better education, which is not true.
No.
And a lot of people mistake, Cleveland State really is a university that can hold their own with anybody. And it would be great that more people knew about that, about how strong academically and how many great professors that we have at this university.
I think that's true, and it's a challenge. I am not a marketing expert, although I have a tremendous, I have very high regard for our marketing and communications team. We've invested pretty substantially in this past year in trying to do a better job of amplifying our story. But there's a lot of stuff out there to break through, as you well know. There's so much information out there. But let me go back to what you were saying about an Ivy League in Cleveland State. I've dedicated essentially my entire adult life to higher education, with a little stint in, as a high school principal. And I would say that more and more, I always believed this, now I am so utterly convinced of it, it really has to do with fit. It has to do with, is this the right place for this individual? And there's not one right place, but there are a whole lot of bad places, wrong fits for students. So I graduated from a place much like Cleveland State, a state university in a mid-sized city that had a, you know, not an Ivy League reputation. I don't think it's really slowed me down.
No.
And I know people who graduated from Ivy League institutions who had a great experience and some who had a mediocre experience, some who left there and went someplace else. It really depends on can you find the right fit. I think we do, young people in particular, they're just figuring out how to be an adult. And we're sending this message that you got to get into these top-tier places, which is an enormous amount of pressure for, I think, kind of all the wrong reasons.
Right. So, it's all about networking, but it's not really about education as much as it is networking with powerful people.
Exactly. So one of the things I think we need to do, all of us in higher ed need to do, if we really want to be good citizens to society, is to market really what we are. Not that we're the best, not that. But here's what you would get at Cleveland State. Here's what you would get at whatever institution. So that it's sort of a buyer beware. And part of this is making sure that a large part of our marketing is bringing people to campus so they can see it.
Mm-hmm.
We really understand. Meet with faculty so you understand. You know, if you want a pastoral setting with, you know, farm fields and cows, you're probably not going to want to be at Cleveland State. But if you want an urban experience where you're, you know, a 10-minute walk from Major League basketball, baseball, football, top tier, all of those things, this could be a really appealing place for you. And then think about the educational experience that you would get here. So that's, I feel, can you tell I feel quite strongly about
that? No, I agree with you, Dr. Bloomberg. This university is alive.
It is alive.
And this area wasn't always alive. But now this area is in a renaissance, and new buildings are going up. It's just a beautiful campus. And I think a lot of people that live here take it for granted. It's the people that come from away from Cleveland that come inside and go, wow, look at all this stuff, you know?
Yeah, we have this really interesting data point. We've been trying to do a better job of looking at the data we have and turning it into information. Because, you know, data is just data until you say, what does it mean? How do we ask questions of it? And so one of the questions we asked of all this information we had was, of the people who inquire, like get ready to think about beginning to apply to college, all the people who inquire of us information of CSU, who ends up coming here? And what we know is that about 6% of all of the people who have any kind of inquiry end up actually applying here. That percentage jumps to 40% if a person visits the campus.
Wow.
So being here and seeing it is huge because, just like you say, it's a beautiful urban campus. It's not a rolling hill, pastoral, rural campus.
Right.
It's not that.
Right, it's at Denison, but it's, you know, there's so much here. I mean, firstly, as a student, I want to walk down the street. I can go to Playhouse Square. I can go to hockey, a basketball, or a baseball game. Brown Stadium is only about 2 miles away.
It's a fantastic spot in that regard.
Right.
And increasingly, the dining opportunities are great. The dining opportunities, by the way, on campus are substantially improved. But then also, you don't walk too far off campus and you're, you know, into East 4th eatery space.
Right. You got everything, and everything's coming together nicely. What is one project that has not been completed that you want to see done before you leave Cleveland State?
Oh, there's about 20.
Well, I figured there were quite a few, but is there any one that really sticks with you to go, I really want to get this done?
We unveiled our master plan last year and met with a lot of key constituency groups, our alumni, the Greater Cleveland Partnership. And there was a lot in that master plan that said over the next 10 to 12 years, this is what we would like to see transform. And some of them broadly, thematically, are things that are important to me. Increasing the opportunities for students to live on campus if they would choose to do that. Expanding our kind of high-tech classroom opportunities. Two, I hesitate to say they're my top priorities, but they're things that I really want to see us move on as quickly as is feasible. One is a new arena. And I know that makes people gulp when we think about building a new arena right now as we think about all the headwinds in higher education. But it's a distinguishing characteristic. And we currently have an arena that has 13,000 seats in it. For a campus this size, that's about almost three times too big. And so as Exhibit A of that, I would give you Duke University. I always use this example.
Yeah.
Duke is pretty well known for its basketball.
Right? Sure.
Their arena has 5,000 seats
right.
in it. 5,000 or 5,500. Ours has 13,000. So we have a great fan base and audience at any given game, and Wolstein will still look pretty empty. We've done a lot of analysis that would tell us that a right-sized arena of about 5,500 would also draw a number of events.
Concerts.
Exactly.
Robert Morris University has a nice little arena
exactly.
over there.
Exactly, exactly. But a lot of places, a lot of potential concerts, magicians, performers, look at Wolstein and say, we're not going to be able to fill this. We don't want to use this space. And if we do this, the only way we're going to be able to build an arena is if it's a multi-use arena and that it's activated much of the time with activities for the entire community. So that's one. And the other one is our research labs are woefully outdated, and we need to renovate those. So those are two big projects. And then I want to see our Student Belonging and Success Division thrive. So those would be the things I want.
Those are great plans. And I hope the arena comes. Cameron Indoor Stadium at Duke University is just a remarkable place, but that was built, you know, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's just got a mystique all its own.
I know. And there are places with iconic arenas, I mean, truly iconic, that you would never want to abandon. I think that Wolstein is serving us well. The Convocation Center is workable. But we've had conversations with people who were involved in the building of that who would understand and agree that a different kind of arena with a different kind of load-in, load-out opportunity for performances would serve this institution quite well.
Yeah, it would be nice if they had a sheet of ice there, too.
we'll add that to the wish list, right?
Yeah. Well, the Monsters could actually play there, too. I mean, they're going to play over there, but they could also, you know, have exhibition games. There could be other minor league teams that could play there as well.
There's a lot of ways that we can think about this, and we are working with a national partner who has done this in a lot of areas. Not built them, but consulted on what works. How do you know? Because what we don't want to do is we don't want to do anything dumb. Financially improved,
sure.
And the board wouldn't do this. So we've spent the better part of a year saying, really, could this community support an arena of this size? And so we're not going to move any more quickly than our responses to some of those key questions.
Well, Dr. Bloomberg, thank you for being on the Ray Carr Show. It's always an honor to speak to you, and thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, my pleasure, and thanks for coming over to the office.
I loved it.